This is Twit.
Online hate has been around pretty much since the internet began, but the Washington Post points out that 2018 was the year that the largest internet companies began to measure and disclose how toxic this hate could be. Joining us to discuss this investigation that the Washington Post did into the human experience of online hate is one of the reporters of the story, Jeffrey Fowler. Welcome back to the show, Jeffrey.
Jeffrey.
Hi, guys.
So you usually join us to talk about robots that kids can build or devices that help senior citizens connect to the internet. This is a little different. Tell us what sparked this investigation.
It's the other side of the technology that we live with. And, you know, we at the Post, a whole group of reporters, we just kept talking about all of these stories we were writing about people who were living with hate, and it had become a major part of their lives. For me personally, it started in March when I was in Parkland, Florida, talking to some of the student survivors of the shooting, the school shooting there, and they talked about how they were dealing with it, how they, you know, had to take protections at home, how their Twitter feeds were filled with all of this vile stuff. And so we wanted to take some time and sort of do a story that looks at the other side of hate. You know, we always do stories about, you know, the haters and the people who are going on the attack. But what does it really feel like to live with this stuff? How does it change your life? How does it change how you think about yourself? How does it change your family and how you feel safe at home? So we went out and, you know, found people who were willing to talk about their lived experience with having people attack them online. We went to a lot of different kinds of people. It was a really broad set of folks we approached. Not surprisingly, many of them would not talk on the record mm-hmm. about their experience. They're fearful that talking about it would bring more hate to them. But we did find these seven who have a pretty wide set of experiences to share and really opened my eyes to the reality that, you know, when you're on Twitter or you're on Facebook or Gab or whatever, and you see, you know, that zing or that clap back, and you think like, oh, it's another good one. Like, there's another experience to what's going on just across the screen.
One of the Parkland survivors that you talked to, Cameron Caskey, I was just so moved by what he said. He said people are addicted to being awful and there's nothing we can do about it. But he also was able to joke about some of the horrible things that people sent to him. Tell us more about Cameron.
You know, that was one of the most difficult interviews I've ever done. He clearly is struggling with what he has to live with every day and the hate that he gets on the internet. And he deals with it. One of his coping strategies is to make jokes about it. And he did that a lot. And he said, you know, at first he just tried to find the sort of the horrible comments. And we have some examples in the piece there. Things people said about his little brother, for example. He just tried to find it kind of funny. But then it started to get serious when people started to make very specific, credible threats against his house where he lives. They started sending SWAT teams to his house. And so he's kind of reached a point where he's resigned to the fact that hate is going to be a part of his life. And it's quite a statement about where we've come as a society, that here's this kid who's 18 and in high school and has already decided that, you know, hate is part of being human.
The anonymity of everything just drives this further and further and makes it so much easier. That's one thing that really struck me about a lot of these interviews is that, and I've heard of this outside of just these interviews as well, is this movement towards putting on a good face about it and being like, yeah, well, you know what? Yeah, it really sucks, but I'm going to do my best to not let it bother me. But what I get concerned with in that regard is that sometimes you don't know or understand what the long-term ramifications of this end up being. What is your life look like 10, 15 years down the line when you've put on a good face in light of this really horrendous stuff? And how does that affect your life going forward? I mean, did they have any insight into how they could, like, live the next 10 years of their life in this new kind of world order on the internet and how that might affect them?
Talking with Cameron Caskey, the kid from Parkland, you know, I said, Do you talk with a therapist? Do you think that maybe someday this is going to catch up with you? And he says he thinks in 10 years' time, a lot of the Parkland kids are going to have a lot of problems, and they've just, you know, they've only begun to scratch the surface of that. I think that hate, beyond that case, I think hate can really impact people in a lot of subtle ways that can take a long time to sort of manifest themselves. We have a story in there about a cyclist who's a trans person, and you know, won a big race, but then had it ruined by people saying, you know, oh, you don't deserve to win. So you know, you can take the joy out of a victory, and then what does that do to you as you think about, you know, going on being a cyclist? We told the story of a family in Texas whose son was attacked by bullies in school when he decided to come out as gay on Instagram. And it essentially put him back in the closet, the experience did. And imagine the impact that can have over many years about sort of being proud about who you are.
So you're talking about Ricky Stratton, whose parents are pursuing legal action. And how is that going?
Not very well. That was another really eye-opening thing for me. You know, there's a couple of years ago, many states, including Texas, where they live, developed laws against bullying online, specifically because it can cause kids to commit suicide. But in their case, I learned that it was very, very hard, even though Ricky's mom is a police officer and knows the law and knows how to get justice. She was having a hard time getting the school and local prosecutors to take it seriously and to really use the law to help them get justice. So I think it might be time for another look at those laws and to see if they're really serving the world that we are now all living in.
And you pointed out that, you know, a large part of this was happening on Instagram. Of course, his mom kind of pulled him off Instagram to protect him, to shield him from this stuff. Yet, to a certain degree, this is where a lot of kids are communicating. So at some point, he wants to get back on there. And I think what that did, that really kind of lit a bulb for me around how, you know, I'm a parent, and so I've got a couple of kids, and sometimes, you know, and I have to kind of like push back against the desire or the knee-jerk reaction to say, I don't understand it, therefore I'm going to take it away, or I'm going to prevent them from doing that entirely because when I was a kid, I didn't have that and I grew up just fine. You know, like, I don't want to go into that very familiar parental place necessarily, but I guess my question is that, does that end up being the right approach, or does that create other problems?
I think you're exactly right. It creates other problems. All of these are complicated stories. Look, if you're a gay teen in Texas, Instagram might be where bullies come and make fun of you, but it's also where you have a community, right? It's where you can find other young gay people and other people who support you. So just running away is not the answer. Interestingly, a lot of these folks we spoke with didn't necessarily think the answer was just to blame these tech platforms either. Many of them actually were unaware that these tech platforms were even talking about hate, talking about the problem. They thought it was just their own problems that they had to deal with. So I think there's a lot of work that can be done there, certainly, you know, by Instagram, by Twitter, by Facebook to work on this stuff. And that's part of the reason why they started gathering numbers on hate this year, to sort of give us at least some kind of index as to how things are developing and changing. But it's really complicated. And but what I learned, it's really messy out there right now.
Yeah.
So one of the double-sided coin that you talked about, that, you know, Instagram being the place where you can meet people you might not have met in the past that are like-minded, and also being the place of bullies, that when you talk to Cameron Caskey, he said he sort of blamed himself a little bit for the hate, it sounded like, and said, you know, their problem, the Parkland kids' problem, was they focused on the people and not the issue. But the focusing on the people was what gained so much. That's what caused the traction, right? That's what people, I know for me, like for so many people, it was just these faces of these high school kids that you're like, wow. So, I mean, how do we deal with that? I mean, because it's like there's so much. I would like to think that there was, you know, net positive in terms of, you know, of us being better people. But I don't know, when you talk about, you know, all these kids having to go to therapy because of the hate they've dealt with.
I think you just summed up the world that we live in right now, right? It's because of the internet, we're able to hear these very personal stories and hear the voices of these kids who went through this. And that has had a profound political impact on the United States. And yet, it became a very personal thing for them. And people decided that just because a kid has a political opinion, that it is okay to attack them personally. That's the point we've reached in our society. And so I think we have to question that. Maybe, you know, in these polarized times, we've really been unable to separate a political point of view from who someone is as a person. And I think that's something that maybe we need to think through differently. But yeah, that is the cost. You know, these kids lived through the darkest day of their lives at school, and then we sent them to battle on the internet.
Yeah, right. And and it's not just the anonymity of it all. It's also just the large scale that these social networks are operating in. And the social media kind of responsibility around that when a person has a large audience. You know, some of these interviews kind of alluded to the fact that it's very easy for someone with a large audience to, whether they realize it or not, mobilize against or for somebody simply by putting out a single tweet of some sort. And then suddenly this person that made some random comment on the internet is, you know, basically their life is plagued for weeks, months, years, potentially around that. They bear some responsibility around this as well, right? Like their public message has that power to mobilize. I don't know how any of this is enforced. And I think that's the big trick of all of this, is that how do you enforce it when it's people being people?
Yeah, you brought up a case that I think is one of the most fascinating stories we share in this piece. This is a woman named Juana Thompson, who is a culture writer on the internet. And she earlier in the year tweeted a critique of Nicki Minaj. And it wasn't even that harsh a critique. She was just saying, I kind of wish Nicki would make some more mature content. Showing that she's growing up, getting older. But Nicki did not like it and obliquely sort of responded to her, and Nicki's fans caught on. And then the fan culture of the internet is not just about sort of celebrating things anymore. It became about attacking this woman. Mm-hmm. And she had to live with that. She says, cost her a job, and it cost her people just saying awful things about her. Then they found pictures of her daughter and started photoshopping them. So it was very interesting. And from her perspective, Nicki Minaj shared some of that responsibility. Now, Nicki never expressly said, hello, Barbs, and that's the name of her fans, go attack this woman. But she let it go on, and she saw that it was happening. And with the fan culture on the internet, like, celebrities share some of this power. And I don't know that they've all really thought through what that means and what responsibility comes with it.
And the story of Charlie Wilkins is another one. I mean, you don't even have to say anything or be famous or do anything. I mean, talk a little bit about Charlie Wilkins.
This is a guy who is a professional skateboarder who happens to have the same name as somebody who did something awful, was attacking a 9/11 widow. And when that happened, people confused him for the other person and just started attacking him. And he just couldn't believe what was going on. And at first he started fighting back and saying, wait, no, like, you've got the wrong guy. I also found that horrible. But it didn't really stop the hate flowing at him. So just even a mistaken identity can end up ruining not only your day, your week, your month, your year, but also make you fearful to check your voicemail, fearful that somebody's going to do something crazy at your house.
So can we end this in a positive way?
Guys, I know it's the beginning of a new year, but this is an important topic. We really need to sort of wrestle with the world that we're creating, we're all a part of, and how to treat each other better.
Yeah. I guess just knowing it's out there, hearing these, reading these stories is important. You can read the whole piece at the Washington Post. Jeffrey Feller is a technology columnist for the Washington Post. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Jeffrey.